Tonight's lecture will be looking at the question of what is intelligent systems? What are we going to be doing in this class? How are we going to be approaching it? And the outline is over here. These readings are principally coming from the first six or so sections in Poole and Mackworth, as well as from some other sections in a couple of the other textbooks I mentioned in the previous lecture. So what I'd like to start off doing is discussing the question of what is AI, because, as I mentioned, you can think of intelligent systems as a piece of or a branch of AI. And the answer to this question is, who cares? We're not really interested in what AI is. It's just something that exists to give us some tools to talk about intelligent systems. So as far as we're concerned, AI doesn't really, we don't really care about it. So we're not going to be concerned with that issue. I think I mentioned this in the previous lecture. If you're interested in AI, that's the next course in the sequence. Now, it turns out that isn't quite true, and on occasion, we will go back and visit some issues from artificial intelligence when they bring home some of the points that we're dealing with respect to intelligent systems. But for the most part, all the baggage that is associated with artificial intelligence, in particular this idea that we are trying to understand how it is we as human beings think, right? We don't care anything at all about that. We're not at all interested in what humans do. Which brings us to our next question. So that takes care of this one. What are intelligent systems? Oh, I should say that one of the reasons I do slides is because my handwriting is really bad. And it's compounded by the fact that I don't know how to spell. So if I don't know how to spell something, I'll just kind of scribble it down. So if there's something you can't read on the board, you should just stop me and say, what is that word? And I'll try and make it more clear. What we are interested in, though, is what are these things called intelligent systems? What does it mean to say that you're dealing with intelligent systems? And I'll start off by being unhelpful in I defined intelligent systems in the previous lecture. What did I say it was? Anybody remember that? They are essentially systems that act intelligently, which is a completely unhelpful way to think about it. There are two problems with this definition. The first one is this idea of systems, and then the second one is this notion of intelligence. The systems question, what are systems, is pretty easy to deal with. And essentially, we're going to do this definitionally as opposed to in some more systematic way. And in this class, although not necessarily in the textbook, systems, as far as we're concerned, are software systems. And in particular, they are programs. Okay, now you can have software systems that are larger than a single program, right? You can have collections of programs, and you can have collections of different kinds of programs. So you can have database. Part of your system can be databases and communication and all these other things. Okay, but we're not going to be thinking about those in this class. We're going to be simplifying things down. And so we're going to be principally concerned with single programs that act intelligently. Now, the textbook points out there's a number of different ways that you can look at systems, and in particular, what's another possibility for systems to consider? So I've already taken software. What's left?
Hardware.
Exactly. So can you give me an example of a hardware-based system that acts intelligently?
Processor.
A processor?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there something a little bit more direct from the reading from chapter 1? Robots. Right? That's a hardware system, and you would like them. See, the problem I had with processor and also with real time, although real time is a little sketchy, as we'll see in a minute, is what does it mean to act intelligently? So while you're correct, processors are hardware, it's not clear what it means for a processor to act intelligently. In fact, it's not clear what it means for a processor to act at all, right? Because their processors, well, this isn't true. But if we go back like 20 years to simpler processors, processors are essentially deterministic machines, right? They essentially step by step. They have really no choice in the matter. But, of course, you can make the same argument with programs, too. It gets tricky, and that's why I'm not talking about AI in this class, because you get all these philosophical discussions, which aren't, well, they're interesting, but they're not really relevant to what we're concerned with. And one of the things that we will look at in the second half of this lecture is what does it mean to have, what you have to do to have a robot or an agent, as the Mackworth and Poole call it, act intelligently, right? So we'll be looking at the notion of approaches, the sort of general approach that we're going to be taking in this class. And then in the second half, we will look at a couple of different problems and try and figure out how it is we might organize our solutions so that the result is something that acts intelligent for that particular problem. So as you read the textbook, you will see that some of the sections deal with systems that are essentially defined in terms of software, and others are defined in terms of robots, or what the Mackworth and Poole call agents. I am actually not going to spend too much time talking about agents, at least with respect to agents in particular. That's just because I don't know anything about robotics. But that's the only reason. It's not that it's, I mean, I think it's really interesting, and in fact, it's kind of impressive. You just go on YouTube and search for robots and then watch the videos. It's actually pretty amazing. And you have robots that can walk and things like that. But that involves the real world and physics and all that other stuff, so let's not really get involved with that. All right, so that's what systems are. As far as we're concerned, they're programs, which is convenient because, of course, that's what you're going to be doing in this class is writing programs, which is one of the reasons why I defined it this way. Questions about that? That's pretty straightforward. And, you know, to a certain extent, not really that important. The issue here, of course, and sort of the question begging that I'm doing is, what does it mean to be intelligent? However, I will defend myself against the claim of question begging by pointing out that this use of the word intelligent is in quotes, whereas this use is not. So, to a certain extent, I'm not begging the question here. But let's answer it anyway. So what is intelligence? Oops. What is intelligence? And this I also defined in the previous lecture. And this is a little idiosyncratic, but we'll go into more detail on that. Does anybody remember? Essentially, in this class, we will consider intelligence to be acting like an expert. Okay, so you have some particular domain, and this is the other problem. Well, actually, you have a domain, right? Your system had a domain. Your system, it's unclear what the domain was. Now, you could argue it's process or execution, but I just said, well, that's sort of deterministic, so there's no, you're not acting there, you're just following a sequence of steps. In the case of real-time systems, on the other hand, I suppose in some large sense you could say it's deterministic, but not really. So from that point of view, yeah, maybe you can act as an expert with a real-time system. And we will take a look in greater detail about what it means to do all that. But before we do that, I would like to go back and not so much talk about AI, because this is something that predates AI, but to talk about the motivation for defining intelligence in terms of observable behavior. Because that's what we're doing here, right? We're saying that, well, here's a system, a program, right, and you observe it from the outside. You see some inputs, and then you see some outputs. And what you're trying to do is relate the inputs to the outputs and figure out whether the system in the middle behaved intelligently. And the way that I'm saying that we're going to do that, the way in which you're going to construct your system in the middle, is if it acts like an expert. So this is an observational way to determine intelligence. There are other ways. Okay, but this is the way that we're going to use. And does anybody know what the basis of that kind of observation is? Where does this come from? Where does this notion of observable behaviors come from? Offhand? Mackworth and Poole talk about this a little bit. This little next section here is not from Mackworth and Poole. It's from Navigetsky. This notion of observable, determining intelligence by observation comes from Alan Turing. Who was a mid-20th century English mathematician, and I suppose we could call him computer scientist too. A polymath, certainly. And he, in the 1950s, and I believe somewhere around 1950, developed something that was known as the Turing test. All right, except he didn't call it the Turing test. He called it the imitation game. And he was attempting to ask a more general question, or attempting to answer a more general question, which is, can machines think? How is it possible to figure out whether or not machines can think? Right, which, again, is not what we are interested in. Right? We are interested purely in observational determinations. Okay, this is why I was very careful to cross out what is AI, because we don't care whether or not machines think. We only are interested in whether or not they behave like an expert. Okay? So the imitation game is a game that you can play. Well, not so much a game. It's a test in a certain extent. And it involves three individuals. The first one is the interrogator. Okay. And the interrogator is in their own room. And then we have two subjects. One of the subjects is male, and the other one is female. The interrogator can talk to both of the subjects, but only indirectly. There is some sort of connection between the interrogator and the two subjects, and you can think of it like a terminal, right? There's a terminal in the two subjects' rooms, and then the interrogator has a terminal at the other end of the connection. And this is the only way in which the three parties can communicate. Notice that the two subjects can't communicate directly. All right. Now, what's the point of requiring communication via these terminals? What would you suspect is the point of doing that? why would you do such a thing? An alternative way to think about this problem is, what happens if you don't do this? What happens if you have... Oh, actually, I haven't told you what the problem is yet. So think about that question, and we'll talk about what the problem is. The problem is this. The interrogator has to answer the following question. The purpose of the game for the interrogator is to figure out whether subject B is a woman. Okay, which is not the case. All right? The purpose of subject B is to fool the interrogator. And the purpose of subject A is to convince the interrogator. And they're allowed, the interrogator is essentially allowed to ask questions and get responses back from either of the two subjects. This is the first phase of the game. All right? Any questions about that? Now, let's go back to the question I asked earlier. Why is this notion of communicating through terminals so important here? Now the answer, of course, becomes a little bit more obvious once you understand what it is, the objective of the three parties in the game is. Any suggestions about why it is you might do this? Essentially, the point is to remove subjective impressions. The point of the interrogator is to form an objective opinion about whether or not subject B is a woman. All right, so this is to maintain objectivity. Okay? And that makes sense, right? Because if you essentially allow them all to be in the same room, the answer to the question is obvious, which one is a woman and which one is a man. So this is the first phase of the game. The interrogator asks questions and gets answers and eventually reaches a decision as to whether or not subject B is a woman. And of course, subject B is attempting to fool the interrogator into believing that he is a woman, and the subject A is attempting to convince the interrogator that she is in fact a woman. The second phase of the game, we get rid of subject B and replace them with, what would you think? Again, remember what the objective here is. What is the point of this entire game? So what are we going to, so we're going to get rid of subject B and replace him with what? Again, what's the point of this game? Why are we playing this game? What's the objective here? What's the point? What's the reason we're doing this?
He cannot turn to the person who has first...
No, what... I'm sorry, what...
Actually, once he's finished with the person, with one person...
Right.
He cannot return to him again. For the question.
That's true, because he's made the decision.
Yeah.
Right, but my question is, why are we doing it? Why are they engaging in this game? What's the point here? What is the question, the overall question we are trying to answer? Can machines think, right? That was the whole point behind Alan Turing's investigation. Well, what don't we have in this diagram? We don't have a machine, right? So if we're answering the question, can machines think, and we have three humans, we're not answering that question. So if we get rid of one of the humans, what do we have to replace it with? We have to replace it with a machine. So here is the second phase of the game. Once the interrogator makes their decision about whether or not subject B is a woman or not, then subject B gets replaced by a machine. This is a machine, so that's the symbol for machines. And you play the game again. Again, the interrogator asks questions, and the objective of subject B is to still essentially fool the interrogator into thinking that subject B is a woman. But now, rather than being a man, it's a machine. And if subject B is able to do that, then we can argue that this machine is now intelligent. That's the whole point. That's the Turing test. That's the original imitation game by Alan Turing. Now, of course, this is not the form that most people think about it. It's not the form in which it's presented. Most of the time, it's a one-phase game, and there are only two people involved, the interrogator and the machine, or what is pretending to be a human. And the question is the subject a human or not, not necessarily whether it's a man or a woman. Right, but this is the original Turing test. And it is from this that we essentially have derived our point of view, which is, does it act like an expert? All right, so to a certain extent, we know for a fact that we're dealing with a machine. Right, and the question that we're answering is that machine in acting in such a way that we consider to be intelligent? Okay. Now, that leaves open a question. What is that question now? We have one more part that we have to figure out, and what is that?
Whether it is an expert or not.
Right, and how are we going to do that? That's right. And how are we going to answer that question?
By intelligence.
Right, but what question are we going to ask in particular to answer whether or not it is an expert?
By comparing with you. Comparing with yes, subject B.
In this case, well, no, this is the original. We're gonna take the simplified form of the test and essentially just have an interrogator. Actually, we're just gonna have an observer, right? And so you're going to have an observer that in our case, we are essentially going to have the system. And we're going to be on the outside watching this system, and we're going to be looking at the inputs and the outputs. All right, so this is going to be our form of the imitation game. And what question are we going to ask this system? Well, the question that we're trying to answer is this an intelligent system? All right? And what other question do we have to ask in order to answer that? What is the general approach we are going to take to attempt to answer that? And I mentioned it a couple of minutes ago. Well, what do we have? I mean, we don't have a lot here. What can we observe here? What can we do?
Is it a machine or a
man? I'm sorry?
It's a machine or a man?
No, again, remember what the question is. Well, let me not say that. This is the question we want to answer. Is this system acting like an expert? That's what we have defined intelligent systems to be. Systems that act like experts. So, what are we going to do in order to be able to answer this question? How are we going to answer this question? Sorry?
By testing, comparing the machine and the intelligence.
Okay, but, right. But what, in particular, what are we going to do? How would you tell me to do that? Or how would you do it yourself?
Turing test?
Yes, right, but in particular, what about? Well, what's the only, I mean, really, if you look at that setup there, what's pretty much the only thing you can do here?
By the impressions of input and output?
Exactly. The only things you have available to you are the inputs and the outputs, right? You have the system, but that's a black box. You can't look inside it. Right. So the only thing you can really do is observe the inputs and the outputs. So the question you want to ask is, if I have an expert and that expert receives these inputs, all right, would that expert produce these results as an output? Okay. And if the answer is yes, then you can say that this system is intelligent. Right, that's a pretty straightforward approach to take. So the system, we consider it to be intelligent if it acts like it's intelligent. Right, this is a behavioral observation here. So we're making behavioral observations here about what it means to be an expert. And again, this is another reason why we're differentiating ourselves from AI proper, because this is a really simple point of view. Can't get much traction here. There's a lot of other questions that we're not even going to bother to consider that someone who is doing serious AI research of a kind would want to think about. But again, we're not concerned with that. Now, this personally is not particularly interesting. The reason I'm talking about it is because this is essentially going to be the objective that you're going to have. You want to write programs that answer this question positively. Right? So you're going to develop systems that if someone makes observations, behavioral observations on it, they will say, yes, this system is acting like an expert. Okay? So to a certain extent, this is the objective of this class. It's how do we do this? How do we have systems that will pass this test? Given some inputs, and it will produce some outputs that look a lot like outputs an expert would produce. Okay? Questions about that? But still, there's a question that we have to consider. And what is that? There's one last question that we have to think about with respect to this, and then I promise we'll go on to something else. What does it mean to act like an expert? Right, I mean, I said, all right, a system is intelligent if you give it some inputs and it produces outputs pretty similar to what an expert would produce, and nobody seemed to object to that. So what does it mean to act like an expert? How would you recognize when a set of outputs resembles something that an expert would produce? What does that look like? How would you determine that?
Expected output, then we can say that it acts like an expert.
Right, but how do you recognize that? What does that look like? That's what I'm asking you. Again, how do you know when something looks like an expert? What does an expert do? That's my question.
By installing a software into the system, the programs which we have used in the system.
Right.
Then we know how the program works and gives output.
No, you don't know how the program works. Remember, this is observational here. And the other thing is that's your job. Your job is to make the program work like an expert, right? So the first thing we have to do is figure out what it means to work like to work or behave or act like an expert. And the second thing is you have to actually do that, which is going to be the last two items on the outline. But again, the question is, if you look at some output, how do you recognize it as being from an expert as opposed to an amateur or somebody or just somebody's producing random answers? Well, it turns out there's a number of different ways you can look at it, and I've just picked a couple of them, and these are again from Mackworth and Poole. Well, what would be the most obvious test you can apply to the output to figure out whether or not it's from an expert? Exactly. Is it correct? So, is it strongly correct most of the time? Okay. Now, we have wide fields of applicability here, so it would be probably not very helpful to require that the expert be exactly correct all of the time, because no expert is exactly correct all of the time. For example, think of meteorology. I think meteorologists are experts, right? They're experts in climate and weather. Are they correct all of the time? No, of course not. But we don't hold that against them as long as they're not always wrong. Right? So in the case of short-term weather forecasts, they can actually do pretty well, up in 80s and 90% now. Okay, so they can do pretty well. But they're not always correct. So, again, the most obvious mark of an expert is it is strongly correct most of the time. What else? Anybody else want to take in a shot? Well, another possibility, and this is one of my favorites, is the expert should be able to justify their particular set of outputs, their particular results. All right, so they should be able to answer questions like why. Why do you think it's going to be sunny tomorrow? Right, why do you think it's going to rain? They should be able to give you answers to those questions. If they can't, then you've got to wonder. Right? Or maybe they're just really lucky if they can't really explain what it is they're trying to do or justify why it is they think what it is they believe as the outputs. And this is, in a sense, representing knowledge. What do they know, and how are they applying it? Anything else about recognizing experts? Another mark of an expert is it can increase their success rate over time. What's another word for that? How would you characterize that property, being able to increase the success rate over time? Sorry?
Getting the expected output.
Right, but again, remember that we allow the expert to be wrong on occasion. Right, but what would you expect the behavior of the expert to be over time as they go through their career? Right. You would expect this. They would increase their success rate. And what's another word for that? An important one for you as students. Sorry? That's not how you would increase your success rate. That's a mark of the success rate. Sorry? No, in fact, we don't want to see consistency. We want to see improvement, right? So that's, in fact, not consistency. It's their success rate is increasing over time. Sorry? Progress, yeah, but in particular... Experience, yeah, but learning. Learning from mistakes. And certainly experience is one way to learn, but there are other ways to learn too. All right? And the last one that I will talk about, or that we can use to gauge what it means to act like an expert, that's not how you spell appropriately, A-P-P-R, and the last property is it can appropriately handle relevant changes in the problem domain. Okay, and that's what's known as adaptive. All right, so if I have a meteorologist on the East Coast, it can perform. Give predictions, reasonably accurate predictions, as long as you're talking about near term. Then I can take that expert and move him or her to the desert, you know, someplace out in the middle of California, let's say. And they can still do their job, even though they're no longer on the East Coast. Right? So they can have the ability to appropriately handle relevant changes in their problem domain. They're in a different weather environment, but they know how to adapt to those changes. Now, of course, if I took that meteorologist and put them in a wetsuit and dropped them in the ocean, Well, then they're out of their problem domain, right? They have no idea how ocean currents work or anything like that, so you wouldn't expect them to give accurate weather reports then. But if there are relevant changes in the problem domain, then the expert should be able to adapt to those. Now, there are lots of other characteristics that you might want to apply to determining expert behavior, but these are the four that I'm going to concentrate on because these are the four that we want our systems to exhibit. We want our systems to be an expert, in other words, to be correct a large percentage of the time. We would like them to be able to justify what they've done. Why is it you believe that this particular diagnosis for this set of symptoms is correct? What's your reasoning there? Okay. We would also like them to learn over time. As they make mistakes or as they come into new environments, we would like them to be able to adapt in either way, either to correct their mistakes or to pick up the new clues in the new environment. And this is essentially a lot of what is going to drive our motivation for, in fact, the next section and the rest of the semester. We're going to try to figure out how to write programs that exhibit these behaviors. Okay, so these are the kinds of behaviors that we would like to have in our systems and which you are going to attempt to build in the assignments. So now we've actually gotten down to the answer to the question we asked all the way over there. What are intelligent systems? Intelligent systems are systems that are right pretty much a lot of the time. Doesn't have to be perfect. They are able to explain themselves. And we will see that there are, in fact, some categories of intelligent systems that we're going to look at that really can't explain themselves. Like, for example, artificial neural networks. Nobody really understands how they work. But they do produce good results. They can increase their success rate. They can learn over time. And they can handle changes in the problem domain. This is actually particularly important if you're dealing with robots or agents, which Mackworth and Poole does. Right? We're not going to be so worried about agents in this class. But Mackworth and Poole cover agents a lot. And, of course, this is very important. Right, because agents can be, don't necessarily have to be, but can be mobile in the environment. Right, and that's one of the problems we're going to look at in the second half of this lecture. It's from Mackworth and Poole. Any questions about this? Again, because this, you should be thinking about these things because these are the things you're going to want your programming assignments to exhibit. These are the kinds of behaviors that you want your assignments to show. And these are the things that I'm going to be testing your code to do, whether or not they exhibit these kinds of things. All right? So that takes care of that. So the next question is, all right, so that's what an expert system does, that is a particular kind of system, but that's what our intelligent system does. Now we're going to take a look at this notion of solving problems. But before we do that, let me just give you some examples of the kinds of systems that I'm talking about. And these are three examples from the expert system domain. If you read a history of software, of artificial intelligence, which I believe there's like a small section in Mackworth and Pohl, you'll see that it started in the late 1950s, right, and gathered steam through the 60s, and then essentially flamed out in the 70s. The one bright spot was this notion of expert systems. A number of people during the 1970s developed expert systems, and we will be taking a look at expert systems in, I believe, the third section. This would be chapter 4, I think. I'm not sure. Chapter 4 in Mackworth and Pohl. So the original expert system was known as Dendril. And this was an expert system that did chemical analysis. It was fed as input spectra information from mass spectrometers. Right? You burn a chemical, it produces light. The chemical components of that substance produces light at particular frequencies, which show up as bands of color on the output. Everybody familiar with mass spectroscopy? Right. So the input to the Dendril system was these mass spectroscopy results, and the output is suggested chemical compositions based on what it saw. So that's an example of an expert system, or an intelligent system as we're thinking of it. The second example developed was known as MISON, which was done at Stanford University. And this was an expert system that diagnosed diseases of the blood. So the input would be, you know, tests and symptoms of a patient, and then the output would be suggestions as to what that patient might be suffering in terms of blood-borne diseases. And the last example is Prospector. Which received as input seismic analysis for companies that were looking for minerals in the ground. Generally speaking, the way you look for things in the ground is you set off explosions and you get echoes back from differing density layers in the ground. And you analyze that information to figure out what's down there someplace. You can do other things too, like you can send core samples and things like that. But those are expensive and, you know, they cover a very small area, less than a foot. And so you want to be a little bit intelligent where you sink your core samples. So before you do core samples, you do seismic analysis. And that's what Prospector did. And these were fabulously successful. People looked at these things, they looked at the inputs, they looked at the outputs, and they said, yeah, this is an intelligent system. Right? Because all of these things, I believe, were commercial companies. Right? I know Dendril was, and Prospector was, and I believe MISON was, but it was in a form where they stripped out the blood information and just essentially had an empty shell, which is what's called an expert system shell. We're not going to be talking about that in this class. So these were all successful, both intelligent systems as well as commercial enterprises. But the point here is that they exhibit this idea of intelligence as being inputs and outputs and the relationship between them, and the ability to be considered as an expert. All right? Okay, now we can go on and talk about problem solving. And as you might expect, if you're familiar with the scientific method, there's a lot that goes on in problem solving because you've got to set the table appropriately in order to solve problems. So I'm just going to be talking about problem solving in the abstract here. And as we go through the semester, we will look at particular problems and take a more detailed point of view. But for now, we're just going to look at it more generally. And this is equivalent to, or this is from, section 1.4 in Mapworth and Poole. So, as we have specified it at this point, what we have is a problem and we apply that problem, we have an expert and we give that expert the problem and that expert produces a solution. So in a sense we've inverted that diagram. Right. I've shown you two arrows representing the input and the output with this box in the middle, and I've replaced that with one arrow for the box, which represents the expert, and then I have a problem as the input and the solution as the output. So this is just an inversion of that diagram. Okay. So this is what an expert does, and what we want are systems that behave like experts. So what does that look like? So what we want is we want a system that behaves like the human. So in other words, it should receive a problem, it should do some reasoning, and it should produce an output, which would then be translated into the solution. So it's the same kind of behavior, except now we don't have an expert here. We have a system, a machine, a program. This downward arrow represents translation. Okay, and then this upward arrow represents interpretation. We're not going to talk too much about interpretation because we're going to be dealing with relatively simple problems, so the issues that come up aren't that difficult. Translation, on the other hand, we'll be spending a lot of time on because you've got to go from problems in the real world down to the representation. Now, if you remember from the previous lecture, I said, what kind of course did I say this was? I said this is a particular kind of course. What did I say it was? Said it several times, and it's very important. What kind of course is it? It is a data structures and algorithms course. Remember that? Now, where are the data structures and algorithms in this picture? Sorry?
Translation, please.
So if you were to, well, go ahead, go and point to where you think the data structures are. Somebody said, well, go ahead.
At the reason?
Here?
Here.
You think it's here? Okay, anybody else?
Step-by-step process.
Step-by-step process for what? What do you use data structures for?
For representation,
exactly. So this is the data structures part. So what's this part?
Algorithm.
Exactly, it's the algorithms part. Right, and I think I identified that too as what I meant by a data structures and algorithms course. Right. So the data structures that we are going to be looking at are specialized to represent particular kinds of problems. Right. We'll be looking at particular kinds of data structures that are oriented towards representing particular kinds of problems. Once we have those data structures, well, what do you do with data structures? You calculate with them. Okay? And that calculation's done by the algorithms, and the reason those algorithms are doing these calculations is to compute solutions, right, which is essentially what we're going to be calling reasoning or expert behavior. All right, so our data structures are going to correspond to representations, and our algorithms are going to correspond to reasoning behaviors. Right, and it's going to produce output, which for the most part we'll assume is the same thing as the representation. Again, we're not going to really pay very much attention to this part of the problem, this part of the system. Our interest is going to be in here and here. And this is pretty much what we're going to look at in the second half of this lecture. We're going to look at two example problems, and we are going to think about data structures that might be useful to represent the problems, and then the kind of reasoning that you can use to help solve those problems. All right, so in a sense, this represents the heart of the course. This is what we're going to be doing all semester. And this is the way I'm going to be presenting things. We're going to look at some data structures, and then we're going to look at some algorithms to manipulate those data structures. And we're going to play around like that. There's some other things, too, that we'll get to. Any questions about this? All right, one thing that we have to do is spend a little time talking about solutions, because that will influence the nature of the kind of reasoning that we can do. And this is actually a fairly important trade-off. This will help you determine the way in which you approach the general problem of implementing these kinds of systems. So let's talk about solutions. And again, this is from Mackworth and Poole. And I'm going to be specifying these examples in terms of the well-known traveling distributors problem. So you have a distributor that has to deliver goods, like your UPS or whatever, and they need to go to a bunch of cities, or they need to go to a bunch of locations within a city. And what they would like to do is they would like to have a route that will let them do that efficiently. Okay, so that's the problem. Given a list of locations to receive goods, give me a route that will let me visit those locations, for example, in the least amount of time. So So we will take a look at ways that you can characterize the nature of the solution for that particular kind of problem. And we're going to go from strongest to weakest. All right, so what would you say is the strongest solution to a particular traveling distributor's problem? Right, and how would you characterize that? You're right. Just give me another word for it. Because, again, this is just an example. So if I'm dealing with some other problem, like, for example, the knapsack problem, right? I have a bunch of cans, and I want to put them in my knapsack, but they all won't fit. Right? So I need to put the most valuable cans. And so, you know, again, yes, but, again, how would you characterize that? Right, and how would you characterize the result? It's an optimal result or solution. Right, it's the best you can possibly do. You can't do better. Anybody want to take a flyer on the next level of solution? This is not quite as strong as optimal.
With less cost.
Yes, and so you would characterize that as what? Right, so another way you can think about it is near optimal solution. So, for example, it's not an optimal solution, but it's within 10%. For example. Now, why would I be happy with that? Why would I actually want such a thing? Why are we drawing this distinction? What's the value of drawing this distinction? And this, again, gets to the example of trade-offs now. This actually probably, how many people have taken 512? Anybody? Nobody's taken 512 yet? Well, they'll certainly answer that question. They may have talked about it in 50-whatever it is, whatever the discrete class is, 502, I think. But it turns out that finding, in most cases anyway, finding optimal results is extremely expensive. It takes a long time, takes a lot of computing power. Right. On the other hand, near optimal results can be produced pretty quickly. So if you're willing to spend the time and the resources to produce optimal results, that's great. But if you're not, then near optimal solutions are a better choice to make. All right. And that's the case for UPS. I mean, if you have to deliver packages in the state of New Jersey, running an optimal TDP solution is probably going to take you longer than a day, which means that, you know, it's not going to be any good for you because you need to get those packages out now. Whereas if you have a near optimal solution, you can compute that in about an hour or whatever it takes. So this is a trade-off. You're trading off quality of solution for the amount of time it takes to get to your solution. And this is going to be one of the important trade-offs that you're going to have to understand how to make. Because, again, you'll have choices of data structures and algorithms that you can use. Some of them are going to produce exact results, optimal. Some of them are going to produce near optimal results. But they're going to cost you, and you have to make a choice. On the other hand, if you're just interested in delivering in a small town, then you could probably go for an optimal solution because even though it'll take a long time, that's not a in the larger scheme going to be too long. Okay, next is satisfying. A satisfying solution is one that works. It's not particularly good, but it works. So, for example, it'll get you back by sundown. So you can be home before dark. So it's not optimal, it's not within some constant factor of optimal, but it has some nice properties. So it's a satisficing problem. And in fact, this is where you're going to be most of the time. You want to produce satisficing results because these are too expensive, these are hard to find. It's hard to find results that produce near optimal results. So you're going to end up doing this. And the last one is the weakest, but in fact it's going to be probably for us the most important. It's essentially the middle of the course, as we'll see in a couple of minutes. And that is probably correct solutions. Because in a lot of cases, it will be difficult to determine whether or not you have a solution at all. And so in that case, you have to resort to indicating whether or not how much faith you have in your solution. Right. And again, think about meteorology, right? The meteorologist, what does the meteorologist say if it's going to rain tomorrow? Does the meteorologist say that? Or does the meteorologist say something else? How does the meteorologist say it's going to rain tomorrow? Does the meteorologist say it's going to rain tomorrow? No. What does the meteorologist say? Sorry? Exactly. There's an 80% chance that it's going to rain, right? Because you can't really produce a satisfying solution to that problem. But you can say, well, I believe that it most likely will rain with 80% probability. And, of course, it's an interesting question what that means, but we're not going to be worried too much about that. So probably correct solutions are probably the most important one, and then satisficing. And then these we're not really going to see. So here would be meteorology. The example I've written down is prime testing. Right. If you're doing cryptography, you need big prime numbers. But unfortunately, it's expensive trying to figure out whether numbers, big numbers, are prime. Okay, so an optimal solution is really expensive. If you have 200-digit number and trying to figure out whether or not it's prime, that's going to take a real long time. But there are probabilistic prime tests where if the number fails, it's definitely not prime. But if it passes, it still could not be prime. It's just, you know, it didn't fail for this particular test. So that's an example of a probabilistically correct solution. And as I said, this will be, I believe, then, this will be the chapter after we look at, well, actually, that's not quite true. I think this is the middle of the semester when we look at uncertainty. This is, the other word for this is uncertainty. This is chapter 6 of Mackworth and Poole. Okay. Questions about that? All right. So this is essentially the objective of what you'll be doing this semester, and this is how you can judge what you're doing. All right, the final thing I would like to do is lay out, in a sense, a map of the rest of the semester. Except it's not going to be a map, it's going to be a Venn diagram. So we are going to be looking at two different kinds of systems. Two different classes, if you will, of systems in this semester. And the first one is known as knowledge-based systems. This particular section of the lecture comes from Hopgood, not from Mackworth and Poole. And these correspond to chapters 3 and 4. They're called knowledge-based systems because the general form of the representation is, in a sense, as a database. Okay, we have a database that's going to be storing the facts and rules and information that we use to solve the problem. I'll have a little bit more to say about that in a couple of minutes. The other class of problems that we are going to be dealing with is computational problems. So much for that. And this represents chapters 2, well, actually, we're not doing chapter 2, chapters 6 and 7. Oh, no, wait a minute, that can't be right. I got the chapter numbers wrong. Let's just say 6 and, well, I'm not sure. Because this is actually chapter 6. This part in the middle is uncertainty. And that's chapter 6. So I can look this up very quickly. Seven and 11. So let's see, how many do we have here? We have 2, 4, 5. We're missing one. So knowledge-based systems, 3, 4, and 5, chapter 6, uncertainty, and then computational intelligence, 7 and 11. So that's essentially the way in which we're going to go through the course. So let's talk a little bit about each one of these kinds of intelligent systems, and we'll start with knowledge-based systems. Again, what is our interpretation of, or structure of an intelligent system? What structure have I given you up to this point for intelligent systems? Data structures and algorithms, right? So the question is, what is a knowledge-based system turns into, what do the data structures look like, and what do the algorithms look like? All right, so in the case of a knowledge-based system, the representations are formal representations. We'll be looking at logic, predicate calculus, things like that, constraints, constraint graphs, and so on. And they are a fairly direct representation of the problem domain. In other words, if you look at, for example, the knowledge base of an expert system, it's fairly obvious what's going on. You'll see things like rules. Like this. So if you look inside a knowledge base for an expert system, for example, you'll see something like, if the water temperature is greater than 220 to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, then the water's boiling. All right, I mean, that's a pretty straightforward statement of a fact. For some reason, Meckworth and Poole go off a lot about symbolic representations, and I can understand why, but it's not really that important. But the point here with respect to knowledge-based systems is it's immediately symbolic. I mean, you just look at this and you understand what the symbols are saying, right? I don't even have to give you a problem domain and you know what's going on. Right? And that's because you have an immediate interpretation of this particular representation. The reasoning associated with a knowledge-based system is essentially complex. It's essentially complex, logical, and contingent. Now, complex means that it's kind of hard to predict how an algorithm will work for a particular problem. You can speak about it in general terms, because, of course, you wrote the algorithm. But with respect to a particular problem, it's very difficult to predict the behavior of that algorithm. So that's what complexity means. Logical means merely that there are sets of rules that the algorithm will apply. You can specify sets of rules, and that determines the reasoning. Contingent means that it changes. One of the reasons it's complex is it depends on the nature of the data. Right? So, for example, if the water temperature is not greater than 212, then the water's not boiling, and you're going to do something else. Right? So, the behavior of the algorithm is contingent, which is one of the reasons why it's complex. As is usually the case for these kinds of systems, all right, so that's problem solving. Now we're looking at approach. As is usually the case for computational intelligence, we just flip them around. What do I want to get rid of? Let me see if I can stick it under here. So we are also interested in computational and here the representation, the data structures, is informal. And it is very abstract. You look at the data structure associated with a computationally intelligent system, and you don't understand what's going on. You can't. because essentially what you're dealing with is numbers. Unlike the representation in knowledge-based systems where it was heavily symbolic, in computational systems, it's immediately numeric. So, for example, with respect to neural networks, which we'll talk about in, I forget which chapter, maybe it's 11. Okay? With respect to neural networks, you're looking at weights and a graph. So your representation is a graph, okay, and the knowledge that is being stored in that representation is the weights on the edges between the nodes in the graph. Right? That's an extremely abstract representation. It's like, even if you're doing something very concrete, like predicting whether or not rice is done in a cooker, you're going to be using weights, and it's not at all clear how these things all work. Although, it does work. Another example, if you're talking about genetic algorithms, which we will look at again, I believe, in the last chapter, you're talking about binary chromosomes. I don't know if you know about how chromosomes work, but they're like collections of genes and so forth, and genes are collections of amino acids and blah, 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 blah. Well, in this case, we're going to represent strings of binary digits as chromosomes and play around with those. That's a very abstract representation. It's a little bit more concrete than it is for neural networks, but it's still a fairly abstract representation. In fact, that's one of the difficulties with using genetic algorithms, is getting this representation suitable for the problem that you're trying to solve. In addition, it's an informal structure. There's almost no knowledge. Unlike here, where we have a sort of a database, you can almost think of it as, here it's completely informal. Informal and well, it's actually not quite true to say it's unstructured. Let me not say that. It's difficult to interpret, but there is a structure there, so let me not say it's unstructured. And the reasoning is straightforward. And I'll put that in quotes because the actual reasoning itself is just simple. I mean, essentially, it's mathematics. In particular, it's linear algebra, matrices, principally. So from that point of view, it's straightforward. But understanding why it is this particular set of linear operators does the job is the difficult part, which is why I put straightforward in quotes. Doing the computation is trivial, but understanding why that computation is useful is hard. So you'll notice there's the typical pattern here. We have a formal, a relatively formal and complex representation, but a straightforward solution or algorithm, and here we flip it. We have a straightforward representation, but wait a minute, I got that backwards. I'm sorry. We have a straightforward representation and a complex algorithm in the case of knowledge-based systems. Here we have a complex representation and simple algorithms. Any questions?